incident, right? There's an emperor that's just dying to get out. That was me, not Watson, who said that last bit. Well, George Santayana years ago said, and it's always quoted like it's biblical and it's the unvarnished truth, he said that those who don't learn from history are doomed to repeat it. I don't believe that for a moment. I don't believe it in regard to our leaders. If they keep repeating history, it's not because they haven't learned the lessons, it's because they learned all too well. If the imperialists of today resemble the imperialists of yesterday in their violence and their hypocrisy and their murder and their ruthlessness, it's not because they didn't know about the other cases, it's because they learned what works and what they have to do to defend the people in column A. What we have to do, if you feel discouraged about it, if you feel defeated and all those things, feel that. It's okay. Feel discouraged, feel disgusted, feel defeated. Feel that for a while, and then get back up and start fighting again. It's not because it's a good idea. It's not because it would make a better world. It's because we have to. It's out of necessity. It's for our survival. It's for the survival of real democracy, which they are nibbling away at and cutting back at with all sorts of repressive laws. And it's for the very survival of the earth itself. I have a friend who had a neck problem. He went to an acupuncturist, and the Chinese acupuncturist put a needle in his wrist and put one in his leg. And he said, wait a minute, I don't get the connection. I got a neck, my neck is hurting me, and you're putting a needle in my arm and in my leg. What's the connection? And the Chinese acupuncturist said, whole body connected, take a look. You know, that typical Chinese gentle contempt for the Westerner's idiocy, you know. And so what we got to say, whole society connected, take a look. Whole universe connected, take a look. It's our universe, and we've got to fight to keep it. Thank you. Yes, so will we have some questions? Is that okay?
Yeah. What do you think about the theory?
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, that was Michael Parenti with a critical assessment of the New World Order talk, which he gave in 1991. I want to follow that up by a one-act play, a one-person play that Alan Rickman did in, the late Alan Rickman did in 1989, which I've played on the show before. It's called The Preacher, and in this short one-act play, he portrays one of the most radical figures of the French Revolution, Jacques Roux, and it's very, very moving stuff, so I'm going to play that for you right now. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
God created rich people first, and then showed them the world they would own. And when they came to a field with thousands of headless bodies with torsos and hands like iron, God told them the headless bodies were destined to be poor workers. The rich cried out, "But these heroes with their iron muscles will crush us." "Don't be frightened," answered God. "I shall place very small heads and brains on their bodies, so until they develop them, you've nothing to fear. Who are still the oppressors? The rich. Who are still the oppressed, the poor. Your slavery is their liberty. Your poverty is their prosperity. Priests say the poor must be content with their poverty and they'll find heaven hereafter. Idiots, cretinous rag pickers. My dog Georges has more sense. Don't you know that whilst you're gazing up at heaven, your pockets are being picked clean, your eyes are plucked out, and you're robbed of your birthright, blind to what is done to you? Christ's priests seized mankind in its cradle and broke the bad news, saying, you shapeless stench, you can never be anything but filth. Your only chance of winning a pardon for being so filthy is if you bow low in perfect humility in the face of all the afflictions, sorrows, and injustices heaped upon you. You're poor, and you stay poor. That is how it is meant to be. Life is a bitter ordeal. Don't speak out. Just try and save your worthless soul. You won't be able to, but you'll give us less trouble by trying. And when the time comes for you to die croaking, the darkness will be as hard to bear as the daylight ever was. The church knows its business. It offers fear and punishment, not happiness, certainly not liberty, only servitude, forever and forever. Religion is a liar and a cheat. Yet still you hunger for it. That's why you've sent for me. Jacques Roux, Mad Jacques, Red Roux, preacher of the poor, sower of sedition, subverter of all laws, a priest who saw the light of reason and now proclaims fellowship with all who live in dark dens and desolate places. It's fitting that I should preach perhaps my last sermon in a ruined church in the parish of St. Nicholas, Summer's End. I go before the tribunal tomorrow, charged with revolutionary excess. Now I am, it seems, too revolutionary for the revolution, and so it begins. When power rested in one man, King Louis, all sorts complained of oppression, and the nobility, middle and moneyed men called on the poor to help. Together, we lopped off that top branch of tyranny, but the tree still stands and spreads. New branches hide the sun of freedom from the poor. The Revolutionary Tribunal is one such. I don't recognize its authority to judge me. Only the poor of St. Nicholas can do that. I come here to lay the rags and tatters of my life before my peers. Habits are hard to break, citizens. I come to confess me. Hear my confession. Do not forgive me, Father, for I have not sinned. My own father had 12 children, and as I was the cleverest, he rid himself of me by sending me to school at the Angoulême Seminary. At 15, I was ordained a priest when I knew even less about God than I know now. There was a priest on every dunghill. The scummier they were, the more they sprouted. But I stayed on and became professor of philosophy, teaching students to bear with fortitude the misfortunes of others. Like religion, philosophy solves the problems of the past and the future, never the present. In 79, the Angoulême students rioted over the agony they saw around them and killed a cook by accident. As a suspect teacher with ideas, I was arrested and imprisoned, though I had nothing to do with the incident. A month or so later, I was released. No trial, no inquiry. Authority had decreed it, and I had no say in the matter whether I was to be free or in chains. This is how fires are kindled. Afterwards, I spent 4 years in the chair of experimental medicine at Angoulême, but medicine proved equally useless. Physicians know even less than philosophers and priests gangrened together. They lie. They all lie. Isn't that so, George? You tell him. I've grown hoarse in the telling. In 89, I was given this poor parish of St. Nicholas, and I was born into the real world of starvation and misery, and I saw the horror and the hope, too, for the revolution burst over us, smashed the clamps that held us down, and swept us up, up, with its transforming power. We opened the book we'd never read, and on the first page was the word liberty. Listen. Listen, the revolution was born in violence. Revolutions must be violent. It is the only way to end the greater violence that keeps the majority of mankind in servitude. Do you think that those with privileges would give them up without a fight because you have a charming smile and the best argument? Adjura, adjura. I renounced my alliance to Rome and gave it to France. I became a constitutional priest, put off the mitred robes of privilege and put on the white robes of liberty. I still practice as priest and physician when called on, but I have to earn an honest living as a pamphleteer and municipal official. I live with a good woman widow petted, born Elizabeth Hubert, once laundress to the rich, now my helpmate, soulmate, who sells my pamphlets, 2 sous a copy. We adopted a son, Emile, a sweet, sweet boy. No more of that. Not for your ears, or yours, or yours. My only fear, citizens, is not of death, but of a life without them. George knows. We love them, don't we, George, eh? I was elected a member of the commune and spoke for the poor. I told Robespierre, Saint-Just, Brissot, and the rest that they could never be the revolution, just men, and not to be trusted with power. Anyone with authority becomes an oppressor, a parasitic coat of filth on the hide of the common people. Between those who command and those who obey, there is only hate. Does it follow that I reject all authority? No, but I always keep my hat on in its presence. In the matter of bread, I consult a baker. In the matter of boots, a bootmaker. A house, a builder. For special knowledge, I apply to a specialist. But I don't allow the baker, the bootmaker, or the builder to impose their authority over me. I listen to them with the respect they merit, if any, but I keep the right to judge, criticize, and censure. Why should we treat politicians of whatever stripe, royal or revolutionary, any different? I listen to King Louis, Mirabeau, Lafayette, the same way I listen to the baker and the bootmaker. Don't be fooled by those who set themselves above you. Always look at the bill they are presenting. You have to pay it. And criticize me, too. People thought Citizen Marat and I were enemies because we were forever attacking each other. He called me an extremist, this from a man who declared 300,000 heads weren't enough. But we were never enemies, just revolutionaries doing our duty. Neither of us were popular with the legislators, but it's not my purpose to be popular. I'm here to sting. To stop me stinging, the Assembly hired me to write the report of the King's execution. We didn't do that well, but you'll not squeeze one tear from my eye over the fate of a royal fool and his followers who talked of honor and died without it. To the boneyard with the whole crew, the rich we'll gobble up, tra-lee, tra-la, tra-lie, with truffles in the rump and oysters on each eye. I love the harp. That's how men and women should die, to the sound of harps. They're so precious. King Louis died to the sound of drums. As the recording officer, I went with Citizen Santerre to the Temple prison to escort the king to the place of execution. Santerre brought a carriage and a guard of honor for the occasion. We drove through streets lined with citizens. They had 3 executioners waiting, 3 and 18 drummers. What extravagance is just to kill one man. The knife fell. Louis' head fell with it. The crowd shouted, "Long live the Republic!" And then I saw Citizen Santerre and the other revolutionary officials dipping their handkerchiefs in the king's blood. I wrote it all up in my report, but I was the only one who seemed disgusted by the whole spectacle. Invading armies were about to overwhelm Paris. There was civil strife in the Vendée, rebellions in Lyon and Bordeaux, and good men and women were dying everywhere defending the revolution, even as the traitorous Louis was dying on the scaffold. But the good and the true had no carriages, no 18 drummers and 3 executioners. A Prussian sword in the belly, an English bullet in the chest, and falling face down in the mud was their end. That's how ordinary people die. Meanly, without harps or even drums to play them out, that Louis, that useless toe rag of a man, goes in style as anemic blood gathered up as something precious. A month later, remember, I led the attack on the Paris food merchants. I'm proud of that attack. Those in power condemn me for it, so I know it must have been right. We ask only for food, a home, a little ease, no more crying in the streets, bread, bread, for God's sake. We were at war, and so we accepted such hardships if they were equally shared, but they weren't. We were dying because of filthy bourgeois graft and greed. The slimy, rapacious money-mad exploiters were hoarding food to raise the price on the open market. Legislators wrung their hands, threatened with a whisper, and did nothing. So we flat bellies marched, smashed stalls, broke up at shops and warehouses, and found the bread and meat and other foodstuffs they'd hidden in abundance. They asked us why we did it. We told them because we needed it. Citizen Murrah said we should kill every merchant in sight. We may do with a few score strung up in front of their own shops to encourage the others. And it did. The next morning, the food markets were filled again with fruit and vegetables, bread and meat. Like Jesus, we had performed the miracle of the loaves and fishes. We must appropriate the land and money from the rich who have it in excess and give it to those who need it and live in want. The only way to defend and save the revolution is by pushing it as far as it'll go and then further, and that's never far enough for me. Then Citizen Murrah died. Steel through the heart, painless, when he'd had such a painful life. I miss him. No one left to trust. That's why I agreed to become editor of his paper when his staff asked me to keep the bright flame burning. So when those impotent, excremental conformists, Robespierre and the Jacobin gang, banned women from political power, we took up the cause. They wanted liberty for themselves alone. I wrote that those refugees from the leper house of reaction should be belled and booted headfirst into the nearest sewer. In return, they persuaded Murrah's widow Catherine to denounce me to the revolutionary tribunal for besmirching her husband's memory. Poor sweet Catherine. Grief takes many forms. She wanted to protect her husband's fame. She thought I was trying to take it from him in some way. I shun fame. It always costs too much. Late last night, I went walking through the streets of Paris with Georges. Just the two of us. Georges padding beside me, sniffing every post and doorway, and me smoking my pipe. No. There's nothing better. Making love, perhaps. Or making a revolution. But with a revolution, you have to be right. It was a clear night. And empty streets, and as we passed St. Nicholas's church, something strange happened. I was walking, but suddenly I couldn't hear my own footsteps. Not one. Silence. I was a dead man walking. No more of that. Tomorrow, before the tribunal of mumblers, I shall make no attempt to defend myself. That doesn't mean to say I'll stay silent. Never that. I'll do what I was born to do, attack. If the verdict of that bunch of rotting fishheads goes against me, I die like friend Murrah, though struck down by a better hand. My own. Been a rich confession, after all, friends, deserving of some penance, at least 5 Hail Marys and 26 Amens. After all, I've preached revolution and sedition, slaughtered a king and others, lived in sin, and will probably end even deeper in it by killing myself. In the eyes of the church, it is a 100% record of failure. But on Judgment Day, I expect to stand before my God justified. I do not condemn myself and shall not be condemned. So, amen. If it's to be the last amen, I go gladly. My wife and son will weep, I know. And Georges here will howl a little, won't you, boy? My friends will pause, shake their heads, and move on. For they have the difficult part. Living well is so much harder than dying well. I have tried to help create a people who are skeptical, rational, critical, not easily fooled or impressed, in a word, a free people, ungovernable. It's a dream, of course, but I've been lucky to have lived through times that made the dream seem possible, when just for a moment we stopped being me and mine, you and yours, us and them, and saw ourselves instead as equals in our common humanity. We are of that generation that so transformed the world that future days and nights can never be the same. We poor, clumsy men and women turned the world upside down, inside out, round and about. One last word from my last sermon. The revolution isn't complete, hardly begun. Defend it. Don't sit back. Act. Without action, no life. Without life, no perfection. Without perfection, no eternal peace and freedom. For God is an active power. And we do his work in fighting the great battles. Light against darkness. Love against selfishness. Revolution against reaction. Life against death. Come on, Joe. Time for our walk.
You're listening to CFRU
93.3 in Guelph, Ontario.
The Alice Street Clubhouse is pleased to be hosting our very first art pop-up sale, All Girls Art to the Front, featuring prints, zines, sculptures, and more from 20 talented female artists from across Ontario. Join us at the Alice Street Clubhouse, 49 Alice Street in the Ward, for the opening reception on Friday, April 15th from 8 p.m. to 11 p.m., where you can mix and mingle with some of the artists and enjoy pay-what-you-can snacks and drinks. Then, pop by all weekend. The pop-up gallery will be open both Saturday and Sunday from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. This is a great opportunity to support local female artists and get some great new art pieces for you and your loved ones. Check out facebook.com/AliceStreetHub for more details and a list of all participating artists. We regret that the Alice Street Clubhouse is not physically wheelchair accessible, but we're working on it for spring 2016.
Close to Home, an eclectic mix of Canadian music on CFRU 93.3 FM. Thursday mornings at 7 a.m. with your host, Tom Rydell. I'll make it easier for you to get up and greet the day. Close to Home, Thursday mornings, 7 a.m.
Time to make a clean break from all those sad, neglected clothes that you appreciate from afar but never get around to wearing. Join the stylish cats at the Alice Street Clubhouse for an afternoon of swapping, schmoozing, babing, and buying. $5 entry fee with 5 high-quality swap items, or $10 entry fee without any swap items. All participants will be given a bag to fill of their favorite swap finds. Also, we'll be featuring discounted vintage goodies from Take Time Vintage and Eclipse Vintage. Pay what you can, drinks and snacks will be offered. Come get stylish for less this spring. Check the event listings at facebook.com/AliceStreetHub or email alicestreetclubhouse@gmail.com for more details. This event is happening on April 2nd from 11 to 3, and Alice Street Clubhouse is located at 49 Alice Street in the Ward. We regret that the Alice Street Clubhouse is not physically wheelchair accessible, but we're working on it for spring 2016.
Point 3 FM CFRU. We are speaking to Dr. Michael Parenti. Okay, hello everyone.
Okay, hello everyone. You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. We are speaking to Dr. Michael Parenti, progressive author and scholar based in Berkeley, California, and we're going to talk to him about his recent book, which I believe just came out in April of this year. It's called Profit Pathology and Other Indecencies. And you can read more of Michael's stuff at michaelparenti.org. And I'll mention that again later on. So hello, Michael. How's it going?
Hello, how are you, Siegfried?
Pretty good. It's been a while since we last talked, so I'm glad we got this opportunity to do so, especially in light of, well, I mean, just everything that's been going on in the world now and, like, the appropriate timing, I think, of this this book you've just put out. So,
thank you.
Yeah, if we maybe could just kind of launch right into things. My first question is basically if you could just outline what is austerity.
Well, austerity is the imposition, the imposing upon the working people scarcity and hardship, and that's done by those at the top who work us and work us.
Mm-hmm.
And who have all sorts of political rallies where they talk about the loafers and the lazy people and who don't want to work and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So they blame, the poor are always blamed for their own poverty. They are seen as the authors of their own poverty when in fact that's not true. And the truth is that wealth creates poverty. In many instances, poverty is the creation by wealth. I mean, slaves wasn't their laziness. They put in 18-hour days of toil of all kinds, and the plantation owners' wealth and luxury and accumulation was from the exploitation of the poor. So that's how you get wealth. A few people will expropriate the land and labor and resources of everybody else. That's one of the points one has to make. Well, mm-hmm. what was it you were asking again?
Well, this is what is austerity, basically, right? Like, of course, we're hearing this term like all the time. These days, like about austerity, the need for austerity. It's like the language, the chosen language, you could say, of the elite, which is kind of imposing this. And you see in Europe, we see in North America, we see like really all over the world now since the recession.
They don't want to say homelessness and hunger and no access to medical care.
Right.
You know, they call it austerity, you know, like learn to curb and don't be a freeloader and all that, when in fact it's the rich, it's that 1% or one fraction of 1% at the top that is really the freeloader. Nobody goes to the government for more handouts than the very, very super rich. They they have enormous amounts of policies and programs for their own benefit. If I don't lose my voice here, I think you got my point.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, and it almost seems like austerity is almost like a feature of the capitalist system in general. It's just the word maybe has kind of come into vogue, but I mean, they've been doing this for a long time, right?
Yeah, they most certainly have been doing it for a long time. Yes, that's correct. Yes. And whenever there was a set of circumstances at World War II that changed things around a bit. We came out of a deep depression that had lasted about 15 years. I mean, the New Deal did a lot of good things, but, you know, it never really got the U.S. out of its depression. And then came the war.
Mm-hmm.
The war was actually a lot of good-paying jobs for people. The ruling class spent amounts of money to kill people and destroy towns and cities, an amount that it would not spend in peacetime to get people out of the Depression. But that war got people out of the Depression. 9 million American men, mostly men, almost all men, came back from the war, and there was a GI Bill that was passed for them. And that was a remarkable thing, because unlike the GI Bill today, where where veterans have to also get a a job on the side and, mm-hmm. or take out student loans or whatever else, the GI Bill does not help them the way it promised to really do. But in those days, it did, and it also gave money for small businesses to start and all that. So there was a tremendous burst of prosperity, of spending. there was a pileup of money that people had from 4 years of working in the defense plants where they couldn't spend that money because all those factories were not making refrigerators and stoves and cars. They were making bombs and planes and tanks and things of that sort. So this combination of things, plus there was not a stripping down, and there was a big stripping down of the military, of course, but a substantial military was kept going 1946-47 because of the Cold War was starting. The Red Army was on the Elbe. The big communist parties in France and Italy. The workers in Western Europe were developing social democracies. They were getting free medical care. They were getting job programs, free education. These things that they were doing that because people in Eastern Europe were getting the same kinds of things, and it was a sort of a historic compromise. Which we had to, keep up with the Reds. Here in the communist countries, people spent only one tenth of their salary for rent. They had free medical care. They had free education up to the highest level of their abilities. They had very subsidized and improved transportation, and all these kind of things were happening. So the West had to do some of the same things, and it was what were being built then in those days was you had a well-being that had never existed quite like that before in the West, and that's when the mythology also emerged that America's the land of prosperity, and for whatever prosperity they really advertised it and ideologized it, if I can create a word. It was part of the ideology that only in America we have everybody's got a car now and the whole transportation infrastructure was built with government money, people's public money, to subsidize the automotive industry, and these super highways were built and all of that at public expense for the trucking industry and the automotive industry's benefit. And this went on and on, and then when you got to the late 70s, early 80s, they started turning it all around. Reagan came in, and there was the feeling was, enough is enough, we've got to roll this back. And they've done a terrific job of doing just that thing. And so you now have that great, prosperous middle class that we always heard about and all that, now much pitied and much rolled back and going broke in many instances.
Yeah, so of course we see this kind of momentary historical compromise that now is being clawed back, and I guess austerity is the latest incarnation, at least of the language of that rollback.
Right, austerity and impoverishment and oppression, those were the normal conditions of capitalism in the United States all through the 1800s and the early 1900s, and right up until the late part of the 20th century. 80s or so is a turnaround, and you get more and more of it today. Today, mm-hmm. you have students graduating college with $75,000 debts. You have the same rollback going on, of course, now in Eastern Europe.
Mm-hmm, that's true.
They don't owe the working class anything anymore. They just started rolling them back, Richard Pipes, of all people, I mean, a conservative like him, I'll give him credit. He didn't He didn't suppress the study, but he did a study of all the former communist countries, how things are, and it came out overwhelmingly, people saying it was better under communism.
Mm-hmm.
Better under communism, you know. The farmers would say it was better. We got subsidies. We could sell our stuff and this and that and students. It was better for them. It was better for public transportation. Was better. The healthcare system was more equitable, more accessible, and you can go on. So that's what they're really. The whole game is really a class. Class struggle game, that's what it is.
Yeah. If I could go back to something you mentioned very briefly before, was just how war is now being like tied in with austerity. You see, like, you know, with austerity now, you see increased rise of interventions of like basically the American military and Western military forces abroad, and increased violence around the world. And increased interventions and these kind of things. So how does that really, imperialism, tie in with austerity?
Well, imperialism, the empire feeds off the republic. I mean, where does an empire get its operational wealth from? From the republic, from the
mm-hmm.
people. You got to tax the American public. How do you get to tax them? And so that you have a federal budget every year in which 52% is for military purposes, right there. That's just 52% off the top. And not to mention a lot of other things, military pensions, all sorts of other stuff. But so the way you do that is you convince your public that this is for their safety. We have to control the world or the world will devour us. And so we've been seeing it again and again and again. Imperialism is an extension, an outgrowth of capitalism, but it's also a way of making the world safe for the plutocracy. That's really its great goal. And to provide places for investment and further profit at greater margins than before.
Yeah, I mean, I guess this kind of goes into the whole profit pathology, right? Because, I mean, I think you even said in one of your talks, you know, the whole idea that capitalism can never stay home. Like, it has to keep expanding. And
yes.
If it doesn't expand, I mean, basically it collapses, right? So, I mean, like imperialism and capitalism, I guess, go hand in hand with regard to that.
It's a mad system. That's mm-hmm. why I said pathology. I mean, yeah, it is a mad system. It's designed to pay workers as little as possible and yet hope that there'll be many workers with lots of spending power to pick up all these commodities and services that I'm creating with these underpaid workers, you know. And my hope is that some other owner will give their workers enough money so they'll have the money to buy up the goods and services that my underpaid workers are creating. But the other owners have the same idea, and they too underpay their workers. And so there's a chronic overproduction. There's a chronic underconsumption. Even though we have a big consumer society, there's all sorts of crap that you got more things, you know, consumer items and gizmos, and even in the area of food, where the food is, I mean, the fast food stuff is uneatable, but there it is, expensive and cheap in some cases. But so imperialism is the outgrowth of capitalism. War brings a false prosperity, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And socialism, what imperialism is socialism coming to the rescue again. Capitalism is always rescued by the government. I mean, the number of programs of research and development in all sorts of areas, the railroad industry, the mining industry, the steel industry, the airline industry, the internet industry, all these things are publicly owned. That plutocratic class that constantly denounces the government constantly scolds the American people, as you're saying, austerity. Stop looking for a handout from the government. Stop running off to the government with silly, wasteful things like Social Security and Medicare.
Mm-hmm.
And all. If I didn't have those, I'd be out on the street right now myself. I'm telling. No, it's not funny.
So, well, I mean, there's a lot of people, right? Like, who face that.
Yeah, yeah. And as I said before, the irony is, of course, that same plutocracy goes to the government, I mean, owns the government, I mean, gets more subsidies,
mm-hmm.
agribusiness, trillions of dollars in subsidies, pharmaceuticals, trillions, the medicine industry, and now with Obamacare, you've got the health insurance industry
mm-hmm.
piping up their racket. It's gotten more, it's given people more services, but it has been a, but these guys get their shakedown before we ever see any services.
Yeah, and I guess this is the real face of the capitalist state, right? The state serving the capitalist class, like these, the Fortune 500. I guess you could say serving their interests and not the interests of the people.
That's correct. It ends up serving their interests. They'll take any good program or need that's needed. They'll argue against it. They'll denounce it. But then they'll put through a version of it where they end up walking away with enormous profits.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think you have to engage in a big ideological struggle against the capitalists or imperialists, at least with people when trying to convince them. What I did in this book, Profit Pathology, is I suggested a very simple empirical approach to, rather than an ideological struggle of grand isms, my superism against your superism or whatever, and just do empirical choices. Just look at things. I say, let's have socialism wherever socialism works better than capitalism. Well, we've been taught that socialism's a flop and it doesn't work, and that's that. But, public utilities work much better than private utilities. The rates are cheaper. The service is better. You don't have CEOs who are making $2, $3, $4 million a year as CEO of the utility. You don't have all the kickbacks and whatever else.
Mm-hmm.
We have a private utility here in California, PG&E, which brought death to users in San Bruno, where people in San Bruno were smelling gas and complaining and saying there's a gas leak somewhere here, and the company didn't. The company is too busy scooping up profits for itself, and it blew up, and 8 people were killed, and another 35 were seriously hurt, and about 40 or 50 houses. If you had seen the photos, I don't know if you ever got them there. They were staggering. These houses were just blown right off their foundations, just nothing there, torn apart like a tornado or something. So public utilities are better. The rates are lower. Your surplus doesn't go to stockholders to enrich them. Your surplus goes into the public budget, and that helps the taxpayers a little, Let's look at schools. Public schools, public universities are better than private ones. The idea that we now have more and more private for-profit universities, for-profit. The school admits that it creates this university to make profits for its shareholders, not for education. Well, again, it would be a lot cheaper if you just have a public university, that you don't have to be producing large amounts of wealth for the shareholders. All the money goes back into the school. How about public medicine, public health care, public hospitals?
Mm-hmm.
They're better. They're better. And the things that public transportation is so much more efficient, so much better for the environment and the like. Public transportation here carts more people than that congestion and slaughter of cars does. So what do we do for capitalism? Maybe restaurants. Maybe restaurants. We can say it's better that the restaurant is owned by mom and pop, and they really have the little touch to it, than having the state. Judging from my experience with restaurants in socialist countries, I might lean in that direction. So what I'm saying is, instead of getting into an isms fight, let's just go social function by social function and say, well, what's been better? You know, what's been better? Tell us, really.
Yeah, like just kind of bring it down to like that empirical level, right? I mean, I have a similar story, actually. I mean, you were telling the story about what happened in California where, like, you know, those houses were blown away.
Yeah.
Once again, there's a result of that private company, you know, and the cutbacks and all this kind of stuff. A similar thing happened in Ontario in the 1990s. In this case, it had to do with the privatization of water systems. And, you know, this is something that definitely should be in the public domain, needless to say.
Now, if there's an accident with a public system,
yeah, this was
never an end to it, and you say, you see, these systems don't, it's not good, it doesn't work, and you should give it to a private company that's more, and they immediately elevate it into an ism thing, you know, and so forth. But it's not true when it happens to them, when you got the BP blowing up oil floats and destroying half of New Orleans and all that, they just say, oh, that was an accident.
Yeah,
they don't raise the question of, is this the way capitalism operates? Well, this is terrible. This is life-threatening. This is destroying our environment and our city and our people. They don't say that. They just say, well, there's been an accident. We got to clean it up.
And
then the cleanup goes to social.
Also,
and they have to pay for it.
Mm-hmm. Like the public has to pay the cost every time, right? I mean, in the Ontario case, it was a town called Walkerton.
Yes.
And basically this place, you know, they had privatized the water system. And because
it was
of the
a private one, you said, Siegfried, I didn't hear you.
Yeah, they privatized the water system there.
Oh.
And basically what ended up happening is it got contaminated by E. coli lack of oversight and this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
About like 8 people ended up dead, like hundreds more got sick, and most of the people who died were kids, right?
Oh, my God.
So like this kind of thing like happened. It was a big scandal back in like 1995,
Did they put it under public ownership again, or it's still privately owned?
Well, I mean, these days it's like kind of more of like a public-private kind of partnership or whatever it is they call it. I mean, basically it's like maybe some increased like oversight, but it's mostly like in the private domain still.
Yeah.
And there's like a lot of privatization going on now. I know the hydro system's about to get privatized and sold off right up here. It's a big, big thing. I mean, some people are being mobilized around it right now. Because that was the next thing I was actually going to ask you about. Like, how are people fighting back against these kind of policies, which are very, very anti-worker, anti-public in general?
Well, they get angry about certain things. You know, PG&E, the company I was telling you about, they were given $42 million. Again, socialism supporting capitalism. Gave them money to rebuild all various pipelines that had problems, were brittle, leaking, or chipping, or showing signs of being ready to blow up or something.
Mm-hmm.
They did all that, But it didn't really, you know, it wasn't used. It wasn't used for those purposes. PG&E took that money and waged a campaign, a statewide referendum, to prohibit any kind of public utilities in the state of California. They spent millions. They spent millions of dollars on this campaign, and miracle of miracles, they lost anyway. The people.
Yeah.
Did not want to hand over all the utilities to the private profiteers, and I deal with these things in my book. Some of those things, and I also talk about in my book Private Pathology and Other Indecencies. I also talk about how small little things, or you talk about austerity. How about Holocaust? How about extermination? 12 to 18 million Native. Indigenous peoples in North America, who 500 language groups were all destroyed from 1600 to 1890, almost 3 centuries.
Mm-hmm.
Just destruction to take an immense fortune from them. them an immense fortune of mineral deposits, of water, forests, lands, topsoil. I mean, a huge enriched continent taken over, stolen, and killing the people, exterminating the people who are on the land, you know. And that's another thing. And then the immense capital accumulation from slavery, which people don't usually talk about, but you know, cotton was probably the greatest value production of any. I mean, more than coal, more than iron, more than just about anything else for quite a while. It was, and again, that was on the labor of African slaves, people who were brought in here and enslaved in terrible ways. This is the so-called primitive accumulation, indeed primitive, I would say, murderously primitive. And so I guess the story I'm saying is, the system is an amazing system of horrors and abuses and murder and destruction and holocausts, and it's all sort of normal. The crises of capitalism, just about every few years, there's a crisis, there's a panic, there's a drop, there's recessions, and it's still going on to this very day. There's still a recession going on right now.
Mm-hmm. And so would you say, like, people are increasingly waking up to the reality of the system here?
I don't know. There certainly are many who are just as stupid and blind to it and bought into it as ever. They watch Fox News and they get roped in. But there are people who are seeing. Look at the protests of the Occupy movement. That was very unusual for the U.S. anyway. Probably better in Canada. I think ideologically somewhat more developed in Canada than they are in the United States. Although there could be plenty of work done there too, and even in Europe, I think the Europeans were so far ahead and sophisticated. The more I spoke in Europe and went, I realized, my gosh, they got some of the wool has been pulled over their eyes too. In some instances, you know. Yeah, it's just got a lot. There's just an awful. You know where the wake up was with the Occupy movement. It was just that one little phrase, 1% versus 99%.
Right.
So suddenly the great divide that you and I and others have been trying to get across and say, look, there's a great divide here, financially, ideologically, anyway. And then developing it a little more, and you say, wait, it's not 1%. 1% of the American population is 3 million people. No, they're not super rich. You can be up there in the top 3 million with $200,000 a year, and you're up in that bracket almost. This is like a fraction of 1%. You know, it's a hundredth of 1%. That the super rich have never been more unequal among themselves than they are today. And in other words, in America, in any case, we still don't even realize, we don't know how rich the super rich really are. Look at these homes up on the hill here in Berkeley, and then they go for $2 million, and they're very nice homes indeed. I would never be able to afford such a place, but that's not rich, you know. That could be a professor with tenure and some smart investments could probably float a house like that or something. The very rich are people who live in places where you don't see their front yards that easily, you know, because there's a gate and there's a great estate and there's a special pad for a helicopter or a private plane, and they live really very different.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, there certainly has been people waking up, though. I mean, like, I've been quite impressed by the campaigns for raising the minimum wage, which are, like, in a lot of U.S. cities now, and a lot of, like, low-wage workers, like, from McDonald's even, like, who, you know, most people wouldn't even see them going out on strike, but they're going out on strike. And there's like a lot of been quite a few actions. Like it seems like a lot of places, and even in Ontario now, like we're starting to see, you know, raise the minimum wage to $15. Like that's becoming a pretty big thing now.
Yes, yes, and as I say, it gets back to that madness and that contradiction of not paying the people who you need as customers.
It's true, you know. And well, I mean, another thing, of course, like Indigenous peoples. I mean, we talked about that before, all the things that they've suffered at the hands of, like, you know, they say primitive accumulation. Mm-hmm. And they're increasingly politically active, you know, like they, you might have even seen the picture from this when I was in Washington, D.C., like just a few months ago, right? And like, you know, they raised the Mohawk flag outside the White House. And these were people who were coming down in support of Ecuadorian activists who were campaigning against Chevron, you know, what it's done to the Ecuadorian rainforest.
Yeah.
You know, and the devastation that it's caused down there, right? So, I mean, you see these. I mean, that was some very real international solidarity there. And you also had, like, the indigenous dynamic in there as well. And it was very amazing to be a part of that.
And sometimes it does reach a point where the oppression can be so extreme that the people who are oppressed have no choice but to fight back. And, I mean, when you think of it, who the hell can live on $7 an hour? I mean,
it's true.
At least in this country, the way prices are, the prices are still going up, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Gas went down, big deal. Well, that's something, but it's really a shame. It's a shame. It's an insult. It's an offense to people's humanity. It is. So that's what the book is about. I wrote a lot of stuff in there, and it's only 150 pages, but I sort of had fun packing it in. I shouldn't say have fun. Sometimes it was with a painful grimace, but that's the way it goes.
Mm. Well, yeah, I mean, this is some pretty serious stuff we're talking about here, right?
Yes, indeed. Off the record, we've done a half hour. Can we... should we call it quits?
Yeah, we can wrap it up, or if you want to talk some more, I mean, you can. You know, either way.
My voice is going, and I don't know.
Yeah. Well, you know, we can. We can definitely. We can definitely end it here. No problem. But I mean, this book once again like sounds very interesting. I know I'm gonna try to read it as soon as I can. And this is Profit Pathology and Other Indecencies,
mm-hmm.
which I think you who publishes that.
It was it's Rutledge and Paradigm Publishers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. And and once again, like, your website is michaelparenti.org.
That's correct.
And so if people want to, like, read more of your articles or find out about more of your books, mm-hmm. you know, just they can go and check that out. Well,
yes, thank you.
Mm-hmm. And I guess probably what we should end on is Antonio Gramsci's quote. You know, just all we've talked about, you know, we must have a pessimism of the mind, but an optimism of the will.
Right.
Right. I know you've said that many times, and I know I've certainly tried to take that one to heart, you know, given what we're up against, but what these struggles that we have to basically face, what we have to go through.
Mm-hmm.
It's very important. All right. So, Michael Parenti, thank you very much for joining us today on Back in the USSR. I really appreciate this.
Thank you, Siegfried. Thank you.
Okay. I'll talk to you soon. All right.
Right, sure.
Thanks. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you're looking for power, you certainly come to the right place because you are listening to CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph. 250 watts of community power.
For your own pleasure, a well-hidden treasure. Pizza Trocadero. We serve delicious gourmet pizza with daily made dough, homemade sauce, and fresh toppings cut by hand. Ask us for our 2-1 special. Pizza Chocadero, open weekdays till 9, weekends until 10. Located at 7 Municipal, north of College in Edinburgh. Proud to be an independent family-owned business. Call 519-829-2444 or visit chocadero.ca.
A unique blend of New Orleans blues and country, blended with a dash of Canadiana, the Devin Cuddy Band has created a sound all of its own. The Devin Cuddy Band is playing at the River Run Center, 35 Woolwood Street, a physically accessible location, on Friday, April 8th at 8 p.m., part of the Borealis Music Series. Tickets are on sale now at the River Run box office. Call 519-763-3000 or visit riverrun.ca.
Close to Home, an eclectic mix of Canadian music on CFRU 93.3 FM, Thursday mornings at 7 a.m. with your host, Tom Rydell. I'll even play that different Canadian song that you won't hear anywhere else on the radio. Close to Home, Thursday mornings, 7 a.m.
And once more tonight, this is the Underground Show.